Wild, High, and Deep, the podcast, is back. Today, our story is of a PhD in cybersecurity. Now, it's a journey that starts with a love of math and computer programming. Then he had an extended master's that really never finished. Then he went on to his first job at a bank, where he discovered something unusual, and he worked to find a solution. And as a result, he found himself in computer security.
It wasn't even really an interest. It's just something that needed to be done. No one else in the department at the banks or at Lockheed, no one was doing it. I became the department expert in computer security before they realized that they needed one.
Now, there's something else interesting in this journey. During his undergrad years, Joe found himself being drawn to philosophy classes. Now, that's not something you would expect from a math major or someone with an interest in computer programming. But lo and behold, there might not be much of a difference between someone asking the tough questions about the meaning of life and those questions that are guiding the ones and the zeros.
The central question in philosophy is probably, how do you know what you know is true? And that same question comes up in computer science, in computer security. It comes up all over the place. How do you know that something is true? And how do you know that you have to realize the difference between information that you know to be true and information that is only probably true?
From Colorado to Seattle to Oxford, England, today we're piling it high and deep with a PhD that's more than 35 years in the making. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is a production of Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conti, Jr. You can check out my website at themountaingeek.net. It's been a while since I've written anything there, but I'll get back to it, I think. We've had a little bit of an off time dealing with some family vacations. I got a new job trying to keep this thing going. But hey, we're at episode 10 right now, so thanks a lot for sticking around, and I think we'll get this thing back on the road. So let's get listening. You're really going to like Joe Lowry here. Interesting journey, and talking about some things that I've never really thought about in terms of cybersecurity, and it's certainly a topic that's in the news. So enjoy, and let's start shoveling.
We'll do it.
Yeah,
pictures.
There you go. Joe, pronounce your last name for me. Is it Lowry?
Lowry,
okay.
Yeah, rhymes with dowry.
Okay, or I can think of the old military base here in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, no connection to it, but everyone in Denver knows that name.
Absolutely, you sure do. You've been in Denver for a long time?
Yeah, technically I was born in California, but lived there for 2 weeks. My father was in the Navy, but no, I grew up around here.
We're going to be talking about, I think it's your PhD, and in looking at your LinkedIn profile, you've been doing the computer stuff for a good long time.
Yeah.
Was that a love that you found early on as a kid?
I saw the first article in Popular Electronics, 1970s, and I fell in love with it then. I just couldn't help it. I couldn't afford a computer, and my parents couldn't afford a computer until mid-1980s, though. So for a long time, I was writing programs on paper. You know, as a high school student or a middle school student, I was writing programs in a notebook. And it's good exercise. It's a good training for a computer programmer, but I didn't have an actual computer until I could afford to buy one.
What were the subjects in high school that really drove you?
Math. And then I took that to CU in Boulder. My parents were well-meaning but clueless. They raised four good kids, but they didn't give them a lot of guidance. And I hate being the oldest because you have to figure everything out. All your younger siblings, they benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the stone that goes downhill learns the most. But and then you pass that along. You said your dad was in the Navy. Was he a lifer in the Navy?
No. He actually ran the computer department for First National Bank of Denver.
Oh, okay.
And so he took me into the computer room when I was 6 or 8 years old, and I saw the big mainframes and the raised floors and the punched cards, and that's what I wanted to do. I was positive of that from the beginning. So I'm old enough that I just barely missed the punched card era. I mean, I've used that equipment, but it was going out by the time I came in. But I was fascinated by the punched cards and the machines in the machine room at my dad's bank. And I remember one time he brought me into work, and he showed me an entire floor of washing machine-sized disk drives. And he told me proudly that this was 30 billion bytes of storage, which nowadays, of course, is the size of your little fingernail.
Right, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And would cost 60 cents.
Right.
At current storage rates. When I went to CU, I took lots of philosophy classes. I ended up a math major by default because eventually the dean sent me a letter that said pick a major or else. I couldn't major in computer science at that time at CU. There wasn't a computer science major. I wasn't in the engineering school. I was in arts and sciences. So I ended up a math major because there was a loophole in the rules, and math majors were allowed to take all the computer science classes that they wanted.
What was it about math, or what is it about math that still drives your interest?
Well, math divides into two camps, the discrete math and continuous. Continuous math is calculus. Discrete math is number theory. Number theory, of course, is now cryptography. That's probably what got my attention. But once I discovered discrete math, I never looked back. I love number theory. It was great. I had a wonderful professor at CU, Professor Briggs. He died a few years ago, but William Briggs, he was the best math professor ever. I never got higher than a C in his class, but I kept coming back for more and more classes. He never gave me higher than a C, but I took all of his classes.
I had a roommate in college that I remember midterms came by, and he was a chemical engineering math, and he had an arts and science, I want to say like a language. I don't remember what the language was. But I remember getting a call at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning in the room, and I answered the phone, and whoever was on the line broke into this tirade of verbal abuse, thinking I was the roommate, thinking that I was, you know, Craig. And he was angry because Craig was the one that had blown the curve for everybody else.
I don't think math teachers mostly grade on a curve. Math teachers, there's an answer, and it's either right or it's wrong.
Right.
And math teachers don't have any problem at all with failing an entire class.
Math was one of those things I think I enjoyed it well enough. I just couldn't get past there was something that blocked me in it. And when I think about how important the role that math plays in today's society, and you know, we're ruled by the numbers, it seems like, you've been able to make that path. Where did you go after you got your undergrad? What did you do?
Well, I stayed at CU. I wasn't ready to leave yet.
It's Boulder. Come on, no one's really ever ready to leave Boulder.
That's true. I was a business master's degree student for a semester, simply because that was the easiest thing to do, the easiest thing to get into. Once I had graduated, I wasn't ready to leave, and I didn't leave. My parents didn't force me to leave, but I just kept taking math classes. I took one semester of business. I learned a tremendous amount. But I ran screaming back to the math department, and the next semester I was a master's degree student in math and much happier.
What was the focus of your master's work?
Actually, I never finished it. I just kept being a student for a few years until one day I was ready to leave school and go off and get a job, which I did. I simply packed everything I owned into my old Subaru car and drove to a faraway city with no prospects, no job, just trusting that I would be able to get a job, which I did, and I ended up working for First Interstate Bank of Washington as a computer programmer. I got a job as a computer programmer. I worked on the bank systems that run in the branches and handle car loans, boat loans, personal loans, that sort of thing. I wrote the code that calculates the interest rates and the payments and things like that. That was fun.
What was the first computer language you taught yourself?
Actually, it was assembly language on a TI-58C calculator. That was my first computer. It was the smallest one that you could buy, and that was what I could buy myself with money from mowing lawns when I was 14 or 15 years old.
When did how long did you stay at Interstate?
Stayed there for about 7 years. There's a recurring pattern in my career. I tend to be at a company for about 7 years, and then the company lays me off, and I have to go find a different career. So at the end of that time, I coincidentally got married to my high school sweetheart and moved back to Denver at that time. But then I started working for Lockheed. I got that job completely by accident. At the bank, I had discovered some security problems. I wasn't supposed to be a computer security expert. Wasn't my job, wasn't my department. But when I was working at the bank, I accidentally discovered an interesting effect and started writing a paper about it. It wasn't the most challenging computer programming work, so halfway through working at the bank, I had started a night school master's degree program at Seattle University. Seattle U was the first school in the world to start a software engineering master's degree. It seemed like a good idea, and I took it, and I was not one of the first students to graduate from that program, but maybe five or six years in, it was just becoming a going concern. But I graduated with that, but that got me connected to one of the professors in the department, and he encouraged me to turn this research on a computer security issue into an actual paper and publish it. We did that together, and that research caught the attention of Lockheed, and they hired me. I actually went to a job fair, and there was a Lockheed recruiter there who looked at my resume full of banking jobs and was not impressed, but he looked at this side project that I was working on of a computer security issue, which turns out to be something that Lockheed was deeply interested in, and he hired me on the spot based on that. My career has been completely accidental from the beginning. I'm sorry, I don't have a plan.
No, but I think that's what I've found. I mean, 10 interviews into this little project that I've undertaken, nobody really walks in with a specific plan that they're going to go down and eventually get their PhD in whatever. But you found by happenstance, it sounds like, this sudden big interest in computer security issues.
It wasn't even really an interest. It's just something that needed to be done. No one else was doing it, and it was important work that needed to be done, so I started doing it. No one else in the department at the banks or at Lockheed, no one was doing it. It needed to be done, so I started doing it. I became the department expert in computer security before they realized that they needed one.
So let's talk about, you know, I think as we go through this conversation, we'll talk about the evolution of computer security, and we hear today of, you know, just last, we hear today of issues of worms and, you know, viruses, and I know in the, you know, the headlines the last couple of months have been filled with what, you know, the NSA built this virus, and, you know, some evil organization, somebody else got a hold of it, yeah. And now they're distributing it, and through, you know, they're able to, the experts are able to track that virus back to the NSA, and maybe they did or didn't, you know, build it up. You know, we can talk about that if you want, but let's start off in the early to mid 80s, which I think is the time period you're talking about when you're working for the bank. What was the security issues that you had? Because you didn't have, you know, you didn't have the hacker down the street able to dial into your system, did you?
Yeah, computer security has gone through about four generations. The very first computers were developed by the military, and they were in closed areas with guards around them. The computer security threat at first was insiders, misuse of the equipment, or damage to the equipment from outside. Then in the 1970s, when large mainframe computers began to be connected across computer networks, the internet hadn't been invented yet, but large banks and insurance companies were beginning to interconnect their computers. The military was beginning to interconnect their computers. And that's when the first hackers came in as early as the 1970s. Hackers who discovered ways into the telephone networks that connected the computers. By the 1980s, it changed again, and the computer security threat became viruses. When we had a critical mass of computers in the world, a lot of home computers, a lot of business computers in the 1980s, suddenly there were enough computers that viruses were able to spread, mostly through floppy disks. Then in the 1990s, the internet exploded, and the threat became hackers again, individual hackers. By the 2000s, the computer security threat changed again. It became criminals, often in other countries, trying to steal information from computers, specifically trying to steal financial information, identity theft, bank account balances, that kind of thing. And then in the 2010s, it's changed again, and now it's foreign governments are beginning to take an interest in non-military individual and private organizations. That's what, five generations now of computer security threats. They keep changing, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s. And right now we have this very unusual situation where the Russian government or the Chinese government or, you know, basically any government in the world might be interested in your private computer system or the Democratic National Committee's computer system, not for stealing financial information, but for stealing other sensitive information. But I'm not the right person to ask you about. If your computer has a virus, I'm not the
You're
right
not the
person
guy.
To ask. My career has been focused on keeping Russian government hackers out of computer systems. I mean, that's what I did for Lockheed. Long before the 2016 presidential election, I was focused on, you know, keeping the Russian government hackers out of our systems. But as a proxy for that, the U.S. government, the National Security Agency, NSA, I guess my main opponent for the last 20 years has been NSA hackers. Because they test U.S. government systems. NSA has buildings full of tame hackers, and they are literally the best in the world. And it was my job to frustrate those people. And it was my job to help Lockheed build systems that were proof against the Russians, proof against the Chinese, the Israelis, the French, everyone else who might be trying to get into our systems, to build systems that are proof against those world-class hackers. You have to build systems that are proof against your own world-class hackers, and that's what I do. I've never worked for NSA, but I've worked with those people a lot. And if I can frustrate them, then maybe we can frustrate the Russians and the Chinese and the French and everyone else. But there have been a lot of WikiLeaks things lately about, you know, CIA hacking tools, right, and NSA hacking tools. But that just shows that our government is spending its money wisely. CIA and NSA are very good at building hacking tools. That's actually good. In fact, between Edward Snowden's disclosures and WikiLeaks disclosures, which mostly come from CIA, they have different connections into U.S. government systems, and they're able to disclose different aspects of it. It looks to me like NSA and CIA are quite effectively breaking up the problem. NSA is working primarily on compromising core systems in the internet. CIA is mostly working, apparently, on compromising edge systems in the internet. Good division of labor. Both agencies appear to be cooperating effectively. The U.S. government is getting good value for its money there. Before anyone gets the wrong idea, I'm just going to state that I think Edward Snowden was a hero. He did the right thing in the wrong way.
Yeah.
But people ask me that a lot, and I will tell them that Edward Snowden was a hero. He told the people of the United States that their government was eavesdropping on American citizens in violation of its own charter. That's against the law. But think of a giant database like Facebook, for example. 1 billion people around the world in that database. If the business development people at Facebook have not at least tried to sell that database to the CIA, then they're not doing their job. But conversely, if CIA has not at least tried to steal a copy of that database, then they're not doing their job.
Right.
There's an incredible concentration of information in the internet right now, in the World Wide Web. And that's their job, to work to try to break into those systems, just as it's the British government's job to try to break into other countries' systems. It's the Russians' job to try to do this. It's my job to try to keep them out. It's their job to try to get in. And that's the way it should be.
At Lockheed Martin, you say you went from the bank to Lockheed Martin. I get the sense that Lockheed still didn't have this specific security division or a specific... They were interested in security, but they didn't have maybe the department that specifically dealt with it. And were you able to then build that from there?
Well, Lockheed had a department of computer programmers, actually many departments, lots of compartmentation within Lockheed.
Right, because I'm sure you're talking about there're the computer programmers that are programming computers for the spacecraft that are being launched, and like we've got Juno or OSIRIS-REx, all of those. Then you have internal systems that manage people, the human resource information systems, that type of stuff. And then you have the financial systems as well that manage the finances.
Yeah, Lockheed's split into two halves. There's the space systems people. They're mostly unclassified. They're up in Waterton Canyon. they build Mars probes, they build spacecraft, and then you've got the classified side, and they're in other places. they're in very anonymous looking buildings. There's no sign outside that says this building is full of classified work. But within the building, there might be 20 classified programs, and no one in program A knows anything about the people who are working on the other side of the building or in the adjacent room on program B. There are 20 programs in that building. They have code names like L634, and no one knows what they're working on. There's all you see is a heavy steel door with many locks on it and a sign that says closed area L264. No one else in the building has any idea what's going on in there. You've got many of these isolated projects going on in the same building. Each one might have 20 or 30, 40, 50 programmers working on their individual system. Those systems are built by those programmers, and then they're shipped off to NSA to be tested. What Lucky didn't have was someone embedded in one of those programming groups who was thinking like the hackers at NSA and could help them build systems that were more secure before they got to the testers. So that's how I started thinking about it. I started as an internal, I invented the role for myself. I was a programmer. I was just working on, writing a system for, L264A. But I knew it was going to be tested by the NSA people. So I started thinking like them. And after a while, we were building systems that were going through testing much more successfully than other programs. And that's how Lockheed figured out that they needed their own internal hackers. They needed their own internal evil hackers who would help them build reliable systems that when tested by NSA, would be found to be frustratingly difficult to compromise.
How long did you do that?
I started working for Lockheed in 1998, and I was fully into that role, which I had invented accidentally, probably 5 years later. And then I worked another 5 years or so on it internally before I got wanderlust, and I needed to go back to, well, I got burnout. I was burned out. I needed to either quit or go back to school, which I did.
Now, there's a master's. You said you had the master's in computer engineering from the University of Seattle.
Software engineering.
Oh, software engineering. Okay. How many of those folks from that program went off to the Microsoft or the Amazon or
many of them. The Seattle U software engineering program is very, very successful. It sends lots of people to Amazon, lots of people to Microsoft, lots of people to Siemens, and probably half of the people to Boeing. But I just got that because I was working as a programmer for the bank, and I realized that we need to do less programming and more software engineering. So
what's the difference?
Well, there are many programmers in the world, but and they're very good at building systems that work, but building systems that are cost effective and reliable and cost, schedule, and functionality. That's software engineering in a nutshell. Cost, schedule, and functionality. That's what I was taught by some of the very first professors of software engineering at Seattle U. Cost, schedule, and functionality. Specifically, being able to hit a target within 20% of the target 80% of the time. That's the state of software engineering right now.
Okay. How did those, are those then ideas that were your guiding principles then through Lockheed Martin in the work that you did there?
Oh, Lockheed was absolutely thrilled to hire somebody who knew this already. They hired me in an instant. when they realized that I had this software engineering master's degree. It was absolutely the most useful degree I've ever got. Two or three years to get this master's degree in software engineering, and it literally got me the job at Lockheed. They noticed me because of this computer security side research project, but they hired me because of that software engineering degree. And I've told Seattle U this many times, that they are producing very valuable engineers through that program. It's a software engineering master's degree pays off more than any other degree I'm aware of. It is absolutely the right way to do. PhD, on the other hand, not so much a good financial investment.
We'll talk about that here in a minute, because there certainly is. You did not go that traditional route.
I did not.
Of getting your PhD. No. So I'm going to bounce around here just a little bit before we get to the PhD. And I usually try and, you know, we got started pretty quick here. What is it that you do now? Because I think, in terms of our conversation, asking you that question here and then going back to the PhD, I think will make a little bit more sense. So what is what keeps you busy Monday through Friday?
Right now, I am a research scientist.
Okay.
That means I took a vow of poverty, and I work on problems that no one else in the world cares about, but you better believe that someday someone is going to be really glad that someone was working on that problem.
Okay. And where do you do that?
University of Denver.
All righty.
I'm a research assistant professor. That means I don't get a salary. I eat what I can kill. I have to track down my own grants. If I can get grants from any source, then I have a career. If I don't, then I don't. So I'm currently working on my first grant proposal right now, writing it to, I don't know who's going to be the granting agency. I'm pitching DARPA, the U.S. Navy. They're the people who have the money.
Right.
I just have to convince them that I have a viable program that might work. It's risky. It might not work. I'm going to tell them this right up front. It might not work. In fact, part of what I'm proposing, I don't know the answer yet, and it's quite possible that Alan Turing was right all along.
Okay, so let's talk about that real quick. As a research scientist, if something doesn't work, yeah, it kind of goes back to that Edison. What was the Edison quote? You know,
oh, I've discovered 10,000 ways that don't work.
That don't, yeah, you know, there are 10,000 things that don't make a light bulb, but there's, you know, just this one. So it's a similar kind of, I mean, you're just going down a somewhat similar path.
I propose risky projects. I've discovered that granting agencies actually like this approach. It's unusual. I've been told by program officers that they like my proposals because I state up front, this is risky. It might not work. I'm not sure if this is going to work. I think it'll work, but it might not work. Here's why I think it will work. Here's why I think it's an important problem. Let me figure this out, and I'll get you the answer. By the end, you'll know the answer. You'll know if this will work or not. And I try throughout my career to take an appropriate amount of risk with the papers that I submit to conferences and journals. I get rejected about 2 times out of 3, and I figure that that means I've calibrated my level of risk about right. If too many of my papers get accepted, then that means I'm not taking enough risks.
So you did a lot of publishing when you were at Lockheed.
Yes.
You figured you got this wanderlust, you were burnt out, you were itching to go back to school.
Yeah, too many 12-hour days in a row. I was working on the project that would never end. But I ran into this problem at Lockheed that I really wanted to know the answer. No one else was going to figure it out. Why had this one large project failed and this other project succeeded. I'd been there long enough. I spent almost 15 years at Lockheed. I had seen enough large projects fail and enough large projects succeed. I wanted to know, what was the difference? Why did one fail and one succeeded? No one else was going to answer that question, but it would still be valuable to Lockheed to know the answer. So they were okay with it if somebody wanted to go off to grad school and study that problem. So I did.
How did you end up, you know, I'm looking at the dissertation that ended up from...
Oh, how did I end up working on a classified project in a foreign country, you
well,
mean?
That's one of the questions there. But let's first go to how does a Colorado kid end up at the University of Oxford?
Oh, well, it when you do a PhD, you have to go where the professors are who
right.
are working in your subfield. They won't come to you. You have to chase
right.
them. In my case, it came down to the particular problem I was working on. Came down to a choice of three schools. University of Idaho.
Good under, potatoes up there.
Under Professor Jim Elvis Foss. University of Texas at Austin under Boyer and Moore. Or the University of Oxford under Dr. Martin. I applied to all three schools. And Dr. Martin at Oxford was the first to call me back. In fact, on the phone, he asked me if anyone else had contacted me, and he said, don't talk to those other people, because he didn't want me to be poached. it was a huge leap to take. I had to move my family to a foreign country. My daughter was 8 years old. I had to take her out of school. My wife quit her job in this very building at the library, and we all moved to England and lived there for 2 years. It was great for my daughter. She learned a lot at the age of eight.
Yeah,
we had wonderful adventures there. It was great. My Andrea worked at the Bodleian Library, which is for a librarian. It's like the Vatican for librarians. So, actually, over the dinner table, I proposed this idea to her. I said, well, we could move to Idaho, or we could move to Texas, or we could move to Oxford. And she said, Oxford, England? Like two towns over from Shakespeare's birthplace? She decided.
Yeah.
She decided where I would go.
How old were you when you made this move?
There's a very good reason why people do a PhD when they're 25 years old.
Yes.
And not when they're 48 years old. I started it when I was 48, and I finished it when I was 53.
But you only did 2 years at Oxford.
Yes.
You only did 2 years in country.
That was a required residency. Oxford has a rule. You have to live within 12 miles of Carfax Tower for 2 years. That's the rule. For undergraduates, it's 6 miles from Carfax
okay.
Tower. And there's no campus at Oxford.
Right.
The university is the city, and the city is the university. Walking down the street, you know, a tobacco shop, a pub, Department of History, a clothing shop, a restaurant and the engineering department there, it's all mixed up. But it's a wonderful city. I loved Oxford. I loved living there. It was absolutely the most fun thing of my life. It was also the hardest thing I've ever done.
Why did you only stay 2 years?
Because it's very expensive to live there. And because the experimental animals that I was studying were back here. In Washington, D.C., in California, and you know, in classified buildings in Colorado Springs, those were my experimental animals. I was studying U.S. government computer security testers, and I was studying programmers in classified departments in Lockheed. I still had my security clearance. That was quite a project, talking Lockheed into taking all the project records from a couple of classified projects to a foreign country and working on it there. But Lockheed was amazingly cool with it. They looked at my proposal. They asked me some questions about ITAR and export control, and I didn't take any classified information with me, but I shuttled back and forth a lot during the time I was in school to attend classified meetings where I was taking notes on paper. Couldn't walk them out of the room because it's classified information. So my notes would be locked in a safe at the end of the meeting, and after the meeting, I would write up an unclassified version of those notes outside the SCIF, outside the closed room with, you know, metal doors and metal mesh in the walls and the floors and the ceiling to keep the classified information from leaking out. I would write up unclassified versions of those notes and then run them past the security people. So I ended up with a completely unclassified set of data.
Security Test and Evaluation of Cross-Domain Systems is the title of the dissertation. What does that mean?
It means, well, a cross-domain system connects two different networks at different classification levels. The government, U.S. government has confidential, secret, and top secret networks. There are other things above top secret as well. The U.K. government has got restricted, secret, and most secret. Now, if you need to connect those networks together, say in an international coalition, there's a bit of a difference of opinion over whose information is more important. Does top secret dominate most secret? It depends on your perspective. If you ask the British, they will tell you that most secret information is much more important than top secret information. So there's the question of whose information classification dominates is a matter of opinion. Caught in the middle of this problem are the programmers who write cross-domain systems, who build cross-domain systems. They interconnect these systems. And the owners of these multiple classification networks, they don't trust other data owners. They don't trust the programmers who write them. They don't trust their own people. They don't trust anyone. I used to tell audiences when I spoke at conferences that the Navy doesn't trust the Air Force. The Air Force doesn't trust CIA. CIA doesn't trust the Marines. Everyone trusts NSA, but NSA doesn't trust anyone. That was a really good joke before Edward Snowden told us about what NSA was actually doing. Caught in the middle of this are the cross-domain solution developers, the programmers who write these systems. No one trusts and no one likes them very much, but they have to build reliable systems. In fact, they have to build reliable systems out of unreliable components. Mathematically, there are ways to do that. So once these systems are developed, then they have to be tested, and that's where we get into the NSA's tame hackers. I use the example of U.S. and U.K. networks, most secret and top secret, but in fact, a real battlefield coalition network is 13 or 14 international partners, and the U.S. would like to connect the Saudis you've got translators over in Djibouti, you've got Jordan and Syria, maybe not Syria now, but you've got Russian airplanes and American airplanes in the same airspace. They've got to coordinate their air traffic control. Military air traffic control systems are classified, and so you've got to interconnect those systems somehow. I work on the systems that interconnect classified networks belonging to different countries. So yeah, air traffic control of U.S. and Russian aircraft in the same airspace is a perfect example of what a cross-domain system is.
When you first started telling me about your undergrad, you said you took a lot of philosophy classes.
Yes, Professor Miller was the best. The best philosophy professor at CU in Boulder. I loved his classes. I took all of his classes. I wrote him a letter from Oxford shortly before he died. He knew that I was there and I was working on that. There's a message to him on the very last page of my thesis. It's a Greek quotation from Plato. None of the examiners asked me about it. I choose to believe that they all read Greek and knew exactly what it meant. But it was a private message to Professor Miller. And in Greek it says, Credo, we owe a cock to Asclepios, don't forget to pay it. It means we're done. It means I finished it. That's what a PhD is. It's proving that you can finish something. Well, start something, carry it through with no guardrails, and finish it. But most especially, finish it.
What role has the ideas and the foundation that your study of philosophy played, how has that helped you in what you've been able to accomplish? Because so often we hear of, or not we hear of, but we often think of engineering and science and computer programmers, they may not be taking from the humanities like humanities studies do. I guess what I'm trying to say is that philosophy is a gray area.
Oh, philosophy.
You have gone into a fairly black and white area. So how have you been able to incorporate that if you're putting the quote in your dissertation, it's pretty important to you. You spent a lot of time studying philosophy in college. How has that helped shape the decisions that maybe you make, and then has it helped you in terms of building this career in computer security?
Yes. The central question in philosophy is probably, how do you know what you know is true? And that same question comes up in computer science, in computer security. It comes up all over the place. How do you know that something is true? And how do you know the difference between something that I file a lot of things in my head as things that I know that are true, things that I think are true because someone told me and I decided to believe them. There's a difference, and you have to, as a computer programmer, you have to know that you have to realize the difference between information that you know to be true and information that is only probably true. Some people have played with the idea of computer spreadsheets that have the ability to add fuzziness to the numbers. How reliable is this number in this spreadsheet? A budget number might have a certain fuzziness if you know that, well, maybe we could go over that budget just a little bit. So we ought to be able to annotate values in a spreadsheet or annotate dates in a calendar as being somewhat fuzzy. We know that that could move around maybe. And then have that uncertainty or certainty value propagate automatically through the spreadsheet. So by the time you got to page 4 of this spreadsheet and you're looking at the final numbers, you might see them displayed as very blurry, indicating that they should not be relied upon absolutely, because they're based on potentially unreliable information.
Given the exercise that I just went through over the last couple of weeks on a client's large fire claim and the meeting that I had the day before we did this and the discussion with the general contractor who essentially said, yeah, we think this is the number, but we still have to bring the rest of the building down before we really know what this number is, I think that would be a perfect example of why you'd want to have that spreadsheet number be a little fuzzy.
Oh, I can see you grinning across the table because you realize the utility of this. As far as I know, it doesn't exist anywhere. Someone could turn this into a million-dollar idea. You know, that's something I've learned over my career is not to try to keep my ideas to myself. I tell everybody all my ideas because I've learned that no one is going to steal them. No one ever steals a good idea. Somebody once said, if it's truly a good idea, no one's going to steal it. You're going to have to ram it down their throats if it's truly a good idea. So I've made a bit of a career out of just telling everybody all of my good ideas and trusting that no one's going to steal it. If it's truly a good idea, I'm going to have to work on it hard myself. But I don't have time to solve that problem right now.
What did you do? You get the dissertation, you're finished up with that. So it took you 5 years total?
Oh, actually, it took me a bit more than 5 years. Oxford has a hard limit of 4 years.
Okay.
So I graduated as a fourth year. For all of 2011 and 2012 and 2013 and 2014, I was a fourth year.
Okay. That was awfully nice of them to do. Was that just because you had so much data to go through?
And yes.
And just the sheer volume of the work that you had ahead of you?
Yes.
Really, they understood that it necessitated you taking more time.
They weren't happy about it, but I bit off more than I could chew, and eventually I chewed my way through it. But they've all done a PhD before. They understand this because half of them did the same thing. They understand you've got a problem and it won't let go of you. You're obsessed. You want to know the answer to this problem. No one else in the world is interested in it, but you want to know the answer to this problem. It's the only thing that could possibly keep a person going through this process.
It's really interesting, and I was certainly, and am ecstatic that you and I have been able to connect, because as again, I'm only 10 interviews into this project, but it seems to me that a PhD in computer science, and that's what this is.
Yes.
Would be more focused on identifying a new way to write code, a new way to make the ones and zeros do what they need to do within the chipset that's been presented to them. It would seem, but in what we've been talking about, and I asked the question before and it's just materialized in my brain, it's the you're dealing with computer science more from a philosophical standpoint of making sure that all the systems are talking well together.
Yes.
And it's not so much the ones and zeros aspect of it. It's finding the path through the various forests, getting to the same point.
But that's okay, because philosophy is the core of a PhD. You're inventing an entirely new sub field. No one starts a PhD unless they they have a problem that no one else in the world is interested in. But this one person wants to know the answer, has to know the answer. It's okay to invent completely new things to work on. Well, you have to, by definition. You have to make an original contribution to human knowledge. You've got to find a problem that no one else has worked on before. But that's not usually how someone starts a PhD. No one signs up for PhD school and says, somebody hand me a problem, please. I want to work on it. The problem finds you, and then you find a place where you can go and hide in a room for 5 years and just think about that problem and nothing else. That you've got to, there's this problem and it's got hold of you, and you've got to know the answer. You want to know the answer.
But you, from what you said earlier, you had a different idea. You went...
Oh, in fact, what I started, my original research proposal was not what I ended
right.
up with.
And so what happened to that original question? As you had mentioned before, the original question was, why do some big projects succeed and other big projects fail?
Actually, that was my, that was what I ended up with. My original proposal, which, of course, my professors, when I first started, were happy with this. They thought it was an interesting problem. It was very much a how do the bits and bytes go together. It was very much a traditional computer science problem. I accidentally discovered this other problem that of why did this particular system fail and this other system succeeded. I accidentally discovered that when I realized that Lockheed had a huge trove of data that no one was analyzing. The project records from these projects that had succeeded and these projects that had failed, I realized that here was this data that no one had ever analyzed. And so I took a detour and I went and solved that problem. And that's what I ended up graduating with. My original problem, I'm now circling back to that. 7 or 8 years later, and I'm beginning to work on my original problem after taking a detour.
Did Lockheed not want you back, or did you not want to go back? Did you?
Oh, the thing about Lockheed...
That's probably not the right way to put it,
no,
but I mean...
No, you're right. The thing about Lockheed is they never spend their own money on anything. Lockheed spends the U.S. government's money on things. Lockheed does everything... Well, not just the U.S. government, lots of other governments. Lockheed does everything from nuclear weapons to traffic light controls in Australia. But Lockheed never spends their own money. They get contracts to work on problems for the government. They never spend their own money on anything. They spend someone else's money on the problem. I told you I have these ideas, like the spreadsheet uncertainty problem.
Right.
I just have these ideas from time to time, and one day I was actually at Oxford working on my thesis problem, and I was also working remotely for Lockheed. Lockheed was surprisingly cool about it when they heard that I wanted to do this, and they quizzed me on ITAR and security controls and such like that. They said, okay, fine, go off and do, go off and get it out of your system. Go to England, work on it for, they thought, 2 years. Here's a laptop. As far as we're concerned, you're telecommuting from home. They were surprisingly cool about that. So I was working for Lockheed full time at the same time that I was doing my schoolwork full time. Two full time jobs when you're 48 years old. Don't do that. Anyway. My boss had sent out my boss in Denver had sent out a request that he got from the Air Force. They were asking for unusual new ideas, blue sky science fiction kind of ideas. They had some money they wanted to spend. Okay, My boss said, can somebody come up with something that we can send back to them just so that we look good? We look like we're generating ideas. Okay, so I generated, I thought of three or four science fiction ideas, and I sent them back to my boss, and he was happy. Unfortunately, the Air Force bit on one of them. So here I am, sitting in Oxford, seven time zones away, working as a full-time student and also working full-time for Lockheed. I had my Lockheed work to do. And all of a sudden, I have another dissertation problem to work on, another PhD-size problem to work on, because the Air Force bit on this science fiction idea. It was called probabilistic redaction, and it used a Google data set. The Air Force immediately gave us a contract for $832,000 for 3 years, saying, please do this, that you said you could do. So here I am now working three full-time jobs. Well, not three, because Lockheed was very happy with me at that time, because, you know, an $800,000 contract, I was paying my own salary and two and a half other people. So Lockheed, they loved me at that time, because I was actually bringing in more government money for them. That project ran 3 years, concurrently with me doing my thesis work, my classwork in Oxford. But at the end of that project, when the money ran out, Lockheed laid me off. And I was fine with that, because at that time, I needed to focus on my thesis work. So everybody was happy. But when the money ran out, Lockheed laid me off.
What did that next 4 years look like then for you?
Working at home in my basement all by myself, and burning savings.
Uh-huh.
That's what I did. I mean, the reason I started, I knew when I was 6 years old, I knew I wanted to do a PhD. But it took me 20 years of working in industry to save up enough money to do it. And I did it. I worked on it as fast as I could, but it took me another 5 years working at home, burning through savings. And when I finally graduated, I knew that somebody was going to give me a job immediately, and they were going to pay me $200,000 a year, and that didn't happen.
The best laid plans.
Oh yeah, it's so I started a consulting business, and I've been doing some consulting somewhat successfully. I mean, I do good work. It's hard to find customers.
Right.
But I consult for the same companies that Lockheed competes with, and I would happily consult with Lockheed. I just haven't been able to get the attention of anybody over there. 1 year ago, this just after I graduated. See, I'm kind of unusual. I didn't do my PhD 20 years ago. I just graduated.
Right.
I graduated last year. I'm a new grad. Can you tell from all the gray hair? I'm a new grad.
Did you go back to Oxford to walk?
Yes, I did.
Good for you.
It was absolutely, it made it worthwhile. All that work, it was hard work. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But I urge people, don't skip your graduation. Go to it, because sitting in the Sheldonian Theater and listening to the speeches in Latin, it provides a necessary closure. It's a bit like a funeral. Finishing a long project like this, depression is a serious hazard, and your graduation performs the same function in society and in the human mind as a funeral does. It made it feel okay. It made me feel better. And the other thing that I discovered is that while no one wanted to give me a job when I was still a student, as soon as I graduated, I started getting offers suddenly. One offer that I got was from DU. They I taught for DU for a year, and just the end of this summer, they're moving me, promoted me from visiting assistant professor to research assistant professor. So it's technically it's a promotion, but it also means that my salary is I eat what I can kill.
Right. Yep. Are you teaching at all this in the fall?
I taught for a year, and now I'm not teaching at all.
Do you like teaching?
Or are you a research guy? It is the hardest job I've ever done, teaching. No, at this point, I'm assigned to focus on research. I was assigned to teaching, and now I'm assigned to focus on research, so that's what I do. I was taught how to teach by Will Mitchell, who is a brilliant grad student at DU in computer science. He's a PhD student about a year behind me. He's the best teacher I have ever seen, and he taught me how to teach. And I taught for a year, but now I'm assigned to do research, so that's what I'm focusing on.
You're asking risky questions. Or you're asking questions in which there's a high risk of not getting an answer.
I hope not. I would prefer to ask questions that that I can answer, because no one should pay for a bunch of research that doesn't produce an answer. It's that's kind of the definition of a failed experiment. If the experiment doesn't tell you something, then that's a failed experiment. Just because the experiment tells you the answer is no, that's a successful experiment. That's an important point. A failed experiment is one that doesn't tell you anything new. So when I say risky projects, I mean projects that might not work, but you'll know by the end of this project whether that idea is going to work or not. That's what I mean by risky.
Gotcha. Well, Joe, thank you very much. Thanks for piling it high and deep. This was fun.
Thanks for asking.
Thanks to the Arapahoe Library District for getting me a room at the last minute. I had had some kids that were taking over my house, and so lost out on that. But thanks, Joe. Have a great day.
I want to say a big thank you to Joe Lowry. I don't know about you, but certainly a fascinating topic. And perhaps, you know, for me, I had a VIC 20 back when I was in 7th grade or 8th grade, maybe it was. And maybe things would be a little bit different if I'd stuck to the programming and the math. It was always the math. It was always the hard part for me. Thanks for listening. I'm working really hard to make sure that we get these that I get this thing going at least every other week. Going to have some more episodes coming up for you. I've got people that have committed to it. Just got to get them on the calendar. Get that. It's like wrangling cats, it seems like. Anyway, thanks again for listening. Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Check out my website, themountaingeek.net. I promise I've got something fun coming up that's not related to the podcast. I'll just tell you that it's, give you a hint. It's the number 42. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.